Welcome to Enclave on Air. I'm your host today, Megan Hollish. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Alan P. Vanuk about recent updates to the NCCN Clinical Practice Guidelines for Gastrointestinal Cancers. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Vanuk discussed notable updates to the NCCN guidelines for hepatobiliary and colorectal cancers that occurred in 2024, summarized recent evolutions across the GI cancer treatment paradigm, and explain the guidelines' unprecedented shift toward differentiating between treatment recommendations for different subsets of GI cancers.
So in HCC, if we look at the changes, what's new is that we've added tislelizumab as a Category 1 recommendation for HCC. That's first-line systemic therapy. That's the main one. And what that amounts to is yet another study. This is from China, I believe, that looked at another checkpoint inhibitor in patients compared to sorafenib and again showed an advantage in outcome with the tislelizumab. And so that's the basis of it. That's from a paper by Qin, Q-I-N, in JAMA Oncology from last year. That's tislelizumab versus sorafenib in HCC. It's a randomized study. Really what that amounts to, though, is just... And what we don't know is that these different checkpoint inhibitors, these immune therapies, that one is any different from the other. In other words, you've got a bunch of Me Too studies. And so I'm not sure that these are huge advances. So what it amounts to is that in HCC, you now have a number of agents that are approved or in the NCCN guidelines for first-line management. And in distinguishing one from the other is impossible. And likely that these will never be compared head-to-head because these are different companies that have the indication in different study designs and not clear that they want to put their drugs up against each other. The interesting finding in HCC is we've gone from years and years where there were no changes in the guidelines, so we literally had virtually nothing, to now just a very robust set of recommendations that include any number of drugs that are in use or recommended. I think the missing piece for HCC globally for the field is still that all these studies are highly selective for patients with reasonably good liver function. And so I'm not clear that these changes are dramatic in terms of offering options for many patients. And it really just is a Me Too drug for some patients. So that's really what HCC, the advances are. Now, if you go back in over the last couple of years, it's worth talking about HCC in terms of how much has changed. I mean, so we added the checkpoint inhibitors, immune therapies, but we also have a range of combinations that are sort of moving the bar a bit further and further along. And that is, so not just the checkpoint inhibitors, but then some combinations. The key for HCC is still going to be figuring out a biomarker to predict who's going to respond to the checkpoint inhibitors. Because turns out that these patients are not MSI high. Typically, they don't have high tumor mutational burden, and yet some respond, but others don't. And the flaw in the studies with HCC has been that the studies have typically, if you look at median outcomes, so the average across the population, it's not clear that these treatments make a difference because many patients get no benefit at all. So you have to sort of look for the subset of patients who get benefit and make sure your endpoints assess that, let's say, landmarks, percentage of patients without progression in a certain period of time. That's where we stand with HCC. And so I think modest changes in that. In biliary tract cancer, it's a little different in that we've identified part of what's happening in biliary cancers. First of all, is for years and years, we really had no tissue banks with biliary cancer because it's very hard to collect tissue in these patients. Once we did, we figured out there are a couple of targets of mutations that can be targeted, and that's very exciting. And so that's one thing that's changed over the years. And then more recently, what we see in biliary tract cancer, let's say if you take intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, for example, we've added another therapy, we've added combination therapies, again, I think we've been drugged to Valumab, which gemcitabine and cisplatin has now been added, although not as a sort of a not a 2B categorization. A bunch of new therapies for biliary tract cancers that are 2B, which are not major advances. But I do think that in the last couple of years, we've added the IDH1 inhibitors as well as the FGFR fusion inhibitors. So there are a couple of targeted therapies that work in biliary tract cancer. So that's the exciting news there. Nothing dramatically different today, except for adding, again, gemcitabine and durvalumab has made its way into the front line. And I think the other thing that the guidelines are doing is trying to separate out more clearly gallbladder cancer from bile duct cancer, from intrahepatic versus extrahepatic bile duct cancer. They're just, historically, we've lumped them together, and I think we now know that they should be separated. Those are the major changes in hepatobiliary. The other thing that's happening in colorectal, by the way, is we're creating a new guideline for appendix cancer. And that's in the big lot of effort to create a new guideline. But we're just now putting the finishing touches on it. It'll be posted probably in the next couple of months. And that's really important because appendix cancer is a unique disease with special findings, perhaps in the one disease that's amenable to heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy, to debulking, tumor debulking. So that's a big change in the guidelines for colorectal. Historically, colorectal, anal, and appendix were all lumped together, as well as small bowel. Well, a few years ago, we created a small bowel guideline, and now we're creating an appendix guideline. The key is you have to really always be downloading the new versions. I mean, the amazing thing, I think, about the guidelines is that they're living documents, and we update them regularly. So if you have a version on your desktop that's even a few months old, there may very well be changes. We, for example, we met last week about hepatobiliary too. A few weeks ago, we had a call about colorectal cancer, and that's trying to incorporate any changes from ESMO. So I think the most important thing, again, is it's very challenging, but NCCN really works very hard at maintaining its guidelines timely and up to date. And I think so practitioners need to know that they should check out the latest version because there may very well be news. So I think that's the main issue, main thing to remember. The other thing to know is that we try to steer away from really rare things. So for example, the drugs targeting a particular mutation and NTRK, they're called NTRK mutations. And these drugs are approved just for whatever cancer if it's found to have this particular fusion product. Well, turns out that to our knowledge, there's never been a case of HCC that's had that, even though it's approved technically in that setting. So we also try to steer clear of these broad brush approvals or recommendations if there's no data. So yes, there are some treatments that are approved just based on agnostic to the disease and just based on the molecular features. But the guidelines, we try to steer clear of that if there's really no evidence that these exist, let alone experience that these work. Old people last week, and nobody's ever seen one of those, a patient with HCC have that particular mutation. And so we try to steer clear of putting everything if we're not aware that any patients exist with that variant. The challenge is always, are we ahead of the insurers? Of course, it's a little bit of a chicken and egg. The guidelines are, to a great extent, the metric that the insurers use in determining what they cover. And if we happen to be ahead of the insurers, so for example, last year, there were a couple of advances in rectal cancer where we sort of learned that we don't need to do, maybe not everybody needs surgery, not everybody needs radiation. Two studies came out. And because of that, we changed the frequency of MRI follow-up on these patients because we have to monitor them very closely. Well, some insurers weren't up to speed on that, even though we changed the guidelines. And so some practitioners couldn't get insurance coverage in the MRI because the insurers were not caught up on the guidelines. You know, it's, again, I can't emphasize enough how these are living documents and how rapidly they can change. Our goal is really to stay on top of it and stay ahead. After all, if there are advances and we're not getting them out to patients, we're not helping, it's not making a big difference. That's, I think, what our emphasis has been on.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.